251, Chapters 3 and 4 of Gulliver's Travels.
Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 251, In Stitches. This week's episode is brought to you by Knit Circus, the e-newsletter that can arrive in your mailbox delivering three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can sign up at www.knitcircus.com. And SeedPod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative. We publish books, not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? And Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. Today's show is also brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/craftlit for your free audiobook download. Well, hello, and thank you. Thank you so much for all of your birthday wishes and how nice it was to see some of you at Maryland Sheep and Wool. I was only there on Saturday and the weather was not being fantastic. Nothing makes me cranky like humidity. And I hear you laughing because, of course, now we live in Virginia, land of humidity. But it's not Atlanta, which I have been in the summer. And while I love Atlanta the rest of the year, I really didn't like the humidity there in the summer. So, you know, I'm keeping my perspective and appreciating the green that I get for being in the land of humid. So that was loads of fun. And then, of course, the boys had a great time. They got to see the sheepdog trials. We got to see Mary. We got to see Nanette the nanny. We got to see the entire Greenberger clan, Deb and her family. It was great. And then, on Monday, some of you who follow Twitter have already, you already know this, and some of you who are on Facebook, I think, saw it as well. Thing one comes running into the house a little later than normal, screaming that my younger son had fallen and hit his head and was now bleeding from his head. Nothing motivates a mother faster than hearing head wound and your child's name all in one sentence. I raced out of the house with my son, and sure enough, thing two had well, he learned a lesson. He had stolen his older brother's trumpet and was running away with it and had hidden it behind a bush that was right next to a brick wall. And I guess he kind of in one fluid motion ran smack into the brick wall with his head. And he was indeed bleeding. He was on all fours just watching the blood drip, which is really not what a mother should ever have to see. Oh, Lord. So we got a phone, because I ran without my phone. I was in such panic. So run. We get somebody who has a phone and called 911. And boy, were they fast. Just blammo. They were right there. I had managed to stop the flow of blood. So when the EMTs showed up, it was not quite as scary as it had been when he was dripping. But you know, head wounds, how they are. Tricky little buggers. And they said, yeah, he's going to need stitches. So we all got to ride in the ambulance, which was ever so nice. And the guys are wonderful. EMTs, good people. Love the EMTs. I've had nothing but wonderful experiences with EMTs. And had a lovely ride to the hospital, had a lovely stay in the hospital. And for those of you who are on Twitter and were wondering what I was doing, uploading pictures while my son is there on a hospital bed. I was following orders, is what I was doing. He requested that I post pictures because he had met some listeners on Saturday. And so he was thinking that he was having me specifically show you what had happened to him. That's my boy. Publicity conscious at a very young age. But he is fine. He is absolutely fine. He still has a bruise and a lump on his head, and we're getting the stitches out today. But He's absolutely fine. He said it was a great day. And I said, why? And he said, the nurses were nice. I said, and you liked getting all that attention, didn't you? And he got this sly little smile on his face. And he said, yeah. So for the second son, I think that was a momentous occasion and made better, of course, by the fact that he is just fine. And the scar is up underneath his hairline, so he's not worried about his future as a male model. I think he'll be just fine. So that was exciting. Also exciting is the fact that you may have noticed that Audible is back as a sponsor of Craftlit. So if you go to audiblepodcast.com/craftlit and sign up for a free trial membership, you will get a free book, which is exciting, and you will also be supporting the show. The Audible audio that I have been listening to lately, I've actually been jumping back and forth between stuff. I guess I'm a polygamous crafter and evidently also a polygamous book listener because I've been listening to lots of things. I've been listening, obviously, to Gulliver's Travels. I have been listening to Moby Dick, and I hear you shriek in the distance, but it's actually, the beginning of the book is hilarious, and it's a very interestingly wrought book. So I've been having fun doing that. I've been listening to 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami, and I would recommend this book to any of you who like interesting, unique, and intriguing narratives. But it's not funny. It's not like a Jasper Ford book, which I think his books are unique, interesting, and intriguing narratives, but they're funny. This is longer and a lot more serious and odd, but compelling. And I honestly believe that if I weren't listening to it as an Audible book, I would never have made it through this thing. It's the importance of hearing specific individual voices, because I'm not Japanese and I'm not from Japan, and there's a lot about Japanese culture that is unique and new to me, and hearing actual people whose voices I can identify as those characters make it a little less foreign to me, but also make it easier for me to feel welcomed by a culture that I don't know much about. I don't know if that makes any sense. But go visit audiblepodcast.com/craftlit and pick out a book that seems intriguing to you today. Let's see, there's a couple of other things that I wanted to share with you, but we're going to do two chapters today because they're both brief, and we need to kind of get into the satire. So I've got that coming up for you. Dr. Brenner is a friend of ours from Arizona. He is a child psychologist. I think he's a psychologist. Or is he a psychiatrist? I can't remember which, but I can tell you this. The man understands boys. And if you are the mother of a boy, you know what I mean when I say that that can be a tricky thing, because some people don't see boy behavior, you know, the running around, the screaming, the crazy, as quite normal. And they're a lot of times telling us that the boys need meds when in fact the boys just need more recess time. Well, Dr. Brenner he's a thoughtful and wise person. And he's put together a couple of blog posts. He's just started blogging. He's put together a couple of blog posts that I think those of you who are parents of, you know, preteen children may find some benefit from. So I'm going to go ahead and post a link to those articles. I also wanted to encourage you to go take a look at CPOD Publishing's page. They've done formatting on some free classic books, so you can download those from their website. But they also have some novels, and these are indie authors. It's an indie publishing house. You know how I feel about encouraging these kinds of things. But there's a book that I've read on there called After the Strawberry, which I have found to be a fascinating tale. And I encourage you to just go read the write-up and see if you think it's up your alley. I'm hopeful that you will find it as kind of sweet. It's a It's a novel that is written with a delicate touch. And in the middle of crazy world, I found that to be an incredibly pleasant thing to access, you know, to be able to fall into somebody else's world, a world that was quiet and almost kind of stately. So you go take a look, just something to encourage you to do to kind of break out of your shell. And Little Acorn Creations, I think we're going to be seeing some patterns coming from that, which I will link to from the show notes. I also wanted to let you know, I have started to write up the rough pattern for Cheddar, the craftlit critter, and that I'm just going to put up for free. And I'll put that out on the regular newsletter that if you just sign up to be on the Craftlit Just the Books newsletter, that'll go out to everyone who's signed up for the newsletter. And I'll also put it on the subscriber-only newsletter. Then there's going to be a little friend, a Lilliputian friend, a little friend for Cheddar. And his name is Wensleydale. And Wensleydale will be a subscriber-only pattern. And that'll come to you free if you subscribe to and support the podcast that way. And then I will put it up on my Ravelry store for everyone else. But that'll go up sometime this week. I have to finish writing that pattern, and it takes a remarkable amount of time to write a pattern and get it edited in a way that you're happy with, you know, so that it makes sense to people. I know, what a ridiculous idea, right? Who needs to make sense in this world when you can throw anything you want up on the interweb and it lives there forever? And on the subscriber topic, just a reminder, if you donate to the show or choose to subscribe during the month of April or May, you're put into the running for one of the Madame Defarge Political Action Committee t-shirts, the Don't Lose Your Head t-shirts. And I'll just pick a winner at random from the list of people who have supported the show this month. Along with that, I have new subscriber-only exclusive content, and I'm very excited about this. As you know, Julie over at Forgotten Classics and SFF Audio and A Good Story is Hard to Find Because the Woman Doesn't Ever Sleep and Happy Catholic, it's amazing what she gets done in a day. She reviewed my husband's book, Cool for Cats, and also played the audio from his first chapter on her podcast. A lot of our friends and a lot of strangers listened to it and immediately wrote and said, for the love of God, man, would you please finish the book? Because he has a lovely voice. I have finally convinced him to record the rest of the chapters of his book. So here's how it's going to be available to you. It will go out on a different time schedule than the Canterbury Tale bonus audio for the subscribers. It's going to go out on its own schedule. I'm going to push him to try and do a chapter a week, and that'll go out on the subscriber-only newsletter. Then, for people who haven't subscribed for whatever reason, you will then have the ability to download the entire audiobook as an audiobook after he's recorded all the chapters. So you can listen to it as a serial if you are a subscriber, or you can save all of the episodes and listen to it all at once, or you can wait until we're all ready and have compiled all the audio, and then we'll offer it to you as a download. And I am so excited about that, partially because I just think it's a good book, and also because I like listening to his voice too, which I suppose is a really good thing. It would be bad if his voice was like fingernails on a chalkboard to me, wouldn't it? That would be a really, really big problem. And the last little thing I wanted to share with you, I think I talked about this way back on like the Fitzgerald Diamond as Big as a Ritz story. John Hodgman does a podcast, Judge John Hodgman podcast. And he did a courtroom trial for a mother-daughter team who had a disagreement about canning. I think I told you about this. And the proper way to can. And John Hodgman brought on Alton Brown, who my kids call the food scientist because he is. And he was brought in as an expert witness to provide testimony. It's a funny podcast, but it is also a shockingly informative podcast and one that made me feel very good about the traditional ways that I've canned food, because I learned with my mom canning food with my great-grandmother in her kitchen with her equipment, some of which I still have, which I think is so awesome. So I'm going to put a link to that show. I'm also going to let you know, I find that podcast to be just charming all the time. John Hodgman has a very arch character that he kind of portrays himself as, but reading his tweets and listening to him over time, you get the sense that this is just a really nice guy. And in fact, he was on Community last night and just cracked me up. If you haven't started watching Community, try and watch it from the beginning if you can find a way to DVR it or Hulu it or something, because it'll probably make more sense. But Julie, again, Julie, who is my connection to all things interesting, Julie hooked me on it with, I think it was their season finale after season two. It was A Fistful of Paintballs and then For a Few Paintballs More, where the first episode was them using Fistful of Dollars, the Clint Eastwood film, as its model. And then the second one was using Star Wars and the Empire Strikes Back as its model. And they recently did a Law and Order spoof that was, you know, just dead on perfect. They're very clever, and they're very clever writers. And honestly, they make me miss my students that I taught high school to in New York, because a merrier band of misfits you will never find than the people on Community. But the interesting quality of their personalities is something you don't often find on sitcoms, where I don't want to say they're real people, because they're obviously kind of exaggerated versions of real people. But every once in a while, the things that come out of their mouth, I go, oh my gosh, I remember when my kids would say stuff that was that funny or that intelligent or that heartbreaking. Because Community, like Judge John Hodgman, there's heart in there. We just saw the Avengers movie. And again, Marvel really, they get the need for heart, which then makes me want to just go into singing, you gotta have heart. Yeah, I won't do that to you anymore. Oh, last thing about the new subscriber Dealey bit. Just to make sure that it's clear, there's a regular newsletter, totally free, easy to sign up for, on the show notes. Regular old newsletter is how I can contact you about events, about patterns that are up, about things that are going on with the podcast, and in the case of an emergency, I can let you know what's going on. In the sidebar, there's a tip jar. That's for a one-time donation. And then there's a subscribe button. Totally voluntary. Your subscription dollars are a way to support the show and get some extra exclusive content sent to you via the subscriber-only newsletter. In this case, it's the Cool for Cats audio and Canterbury Tales and occasional patterns that will be coming out. Those pieces of audio, Canterbury Tales and Cool for Cats, will eventually be available for everyone to download. But first we have to record it, and sending it out to the subscribers seemed like a good arbitrary deadline to set for myself so that I get it done. So I thought, that's a good time to do it. If you donate at all during the month of April and May, you are put into the running for the Madame Defarge Political Action Committee t-shirt. Now, there was still some weirdness with PayPal not doing the redirection that it's supposed to do, and it's driving me nuts. But what I've started doing is I'm going in a couple times a week into PayPal, taking your names and email addresses out of there and putting them into the subscriber-only newsletter if you didn't do it yourself. So that way, you should be all signed up and ready to go, because the newsletter is how I'm going to deliver the exclusive content to you. And now that I'm getting my act together, you should be getting, people who sign up from today on, you should be getting a confirmation email with information and links and stuff sent to you within a day or two of signing up. So if that hasn't happened, one, check your spam folder. And if it's not in your spam folder, contact me, because something's gone wrong. So trying to be more efficient, getting good stuff out to you, making good audio available, good audio like, yes, Gulliver's Travels. Now, I promised you last week that this week we were going to get down and dirty with a real satire, and it's true. And satire, unlike Tale of Two Cities, where you really just need to know kind of the background of the politics and some interesting things that Dickens is doing and stuff like that. Satire, in order to get it on the many levels that the author intended you to get it on, really does require some knowledge and even possibly slightly more careful listening than you usually do. So, I'm going to give you a tiny bit of background, and then I'm going to play the first part of chapter 3, which is like 3 paragraphs, and then I'm going to stop the audio, and I'm going to go in, and I'm going to systematically explain to you where the jokes are. Some of them you will catch as jokes, just kind of qua joke. Some of them you won't have been able to get the deeper meaning, because oddly enough, the names and the foibles of political figures have changed a little bit since the early 1700s. So I will fill you in. I will give you hints. And my guess is once you see how Swift is setting up the satire, you're going to catch the places that he does it throughout these chapters. I'll break in at the end of chapter 3, go over some stuff for chapter 4, and then play chapter 4 straight through. Now, I know I did this kind of thing for Tale of Two Cities, where I broke into the audio and explained stuff in a couple of really complicated chapters. I know that I've received emails over the years from people saying, oh my gosh, thank you so much, that helped enormously, and other emails from people saying, God, that drove me nuts. So that's one of the reasons why I'm going to play these first opening 3 chapters for you twice, once to dissect and then once to just listen and get kind of a running start at the rest of the chapter. I hope that works better for you, for everyone, so that everyone's needs are kind of met with this, because it is complicated and satire's challenging, but God, when you get it, it feels so good. And on that note, where we left off, Gulliver in Lilliput. They've searched him, they've confiscated some of his stuff, but he's alive and he's doing well, and they aren't shooting arrows at him anymore, at least not right now. Now, the first thing that I'm going to bring up before we listen to this section is I have heard people talk about the tightrope that political leaders are on in trying to please all constituencies. You've also probably heard that trying to get a job is often like a series of jumping through hoops. Well, combine these two ideas and you'll see what Swift is doing in this section. And I will explain this afterwards. The people he's naming represent real people, and you'll find out who shortly. But the thing that I thought was kind of cool about this is that it almost became a parlor game to sit around with this book and try and figure out who he was talking about. And the guys who he's making fun of, because their egos were the size of the planet, loved the fact, for the most part, that they were being made fun of in this book. Interesting, right? It's just like that Primary Colors that Joe Klein wrote about Clinton, and it becomes, you know, a game. It's, oh, is that Stephanopoulos? Oh, that's Clinton. Oh, you know, it's the same thing. So listen for the tightrope imagery. I will go practice saying tightrope, and then I'll catch you on the flip side to give you more details about where Swift was making the jokes.
Chapter 3. The author diverts the emperor and his nobility of both sexes in a very uncommon manner. The diversions of the court of Lilliput described, the author hath his liberty granted him upon certain conditions. My gentleness and good behavior had gained so far on the emperor and his court, and indeed upon the army and people in general, that I began to conceive hopes of getting my liberty in a short time. I took all possible methods to cultivate this favorable disposition. The natives came by degrees to be less apprehensive of any danger from me. I would sometimes lie down and let 5 or 6 of them dance on my hand, and at last the boys and girls would venture to come and play at hide-and-seek in my hair. I had now made a good progress in understanding and speaking their language. The emperor had a mind one day to entertain me with several of the country shows, wherein they exceed all nations I have known, both for dexterity and magnificence. I was diverted with none so much as that of the rope dancers, performed upon a slender white thread extended about 2 foot and 12 inches from the ground, upon which I shall desire liberty with the reader's patience to enlarge a little. This diversion is only practiced by those persons who are candidates for great employments and high favor at court. They are trained in this art from their youth, and are not always of noble birth or liberal education. When a great office is vacant, either by death or disgrace, which often happens, 5 or 6 of those candidates petition the emperor to entertain his majesty and the court with a dance on the rope, and whoever jumps the highest without falling succeeds in the office. Very often the chief ministers themselves are commanded to show their skill and to convince the emperor that they have not lost their faculty. Flimnap, the treasurer, is allowed to cut a caper on the straight rope at least an inch higher than any other lord in the whole empire. I have seen him do the somerset several times together upon a trencher fixed on the rope, which is no thicker than a common pack thread in England. My friend Reldresal, principal secretary for private affairs, is, in my opinion, if I am not partial, the second after the treasurer. The rest of the great officers are much upon a par. These diversions are often attended with fatal accidents, whereof great numbers are on record. I myself have seen 2 or 3 candidates break a limb, but the danger is much greater when the ministers themselves are commanded to show their dexterity, for by contending to excel themselves and their fellows, they strain so far that there is hardly one of them who hath not received a fall, and some of them 2 or 3. I was assured that 1 or 2 before my arrival, Flimnap would have infallibly broke his neck if one of the king's cushions that accidentally lay on the ground had not weakened the force of his fall.
All right, so that's where I'm cutting in. I'm sure you got the implication that the way people get into high office and then prove their worth in high office has nothing to do with being smart or good or useful, but has to do with how they can balance and jump on a wire. So that's the first point that he's that he's making. It's like the Zaphod Beeblebrox school of political achievement. Whoever is most qualified and able to lead will never have the chance to lead. And only the crazy drunk guy with 2 heads is going to make it. The second side of that is the walking the tightrope thing, but not in a positive way. It's the flip-flopping, the shifting sides, the going where the wind blows you kind of thing that he's making a comment on and criticizing. However, it goes further than that. When he talks about Flimnap, the treasurer is allowed to cut a caper on the straight rope at least an inch higher than any other lord in the whole empire. So he's, Gulliver is giving him a compliment here, but Swift isn't. And it gets even more interesting because there is no question but that Flimnap is a representation of Robert Walpole. Now, this is a name that you've probably heard. He was a Whig. He served as Secretary of War from 1708 to 1710. And then the Whigs fell out of power and the Tories came in. But when George I became the king and the Whigs returned to power, Walpole is the one who headed the secret committee that investigated Swift's friends. So he doesn't like Walpole very much. And Walpole is Flimnap. Now, Walpole is also kind of an interesting character because since George I didn't speak any English, he really had to rely on his staff. And one of the people who he relied on quite a bit was Walpole, which expanded the powers of the prime minister. So in many ways, Robert Walpole was kind of the first modern day prime minister back in the 1700s. And he was prime minister from 1715 to 1717, and then again from 1721 to 1742. Now, the first time he falls from power in 1717, this comes up in our passage again. There's the bit where he says, "I was assured that 1 or 2 before my arrival, Flimnap would have infallibly broken his neck if one of the king's cushions that accidentally lay on the ground had not weakened the force of his fall." Now, Aaron Ziegler is doing an incredible job here because he is stressing places where there is reason to stress. And in this case, King's cushions is italicized. And it's italicized because when Walpole fell from power, he had made nice with the Duchess of Kendal, one of the king's mistresses. And so he literally landed on one of the king's cushions, and she's the one who got him back into power. And that's why he had a second term as prime minister. That's the kind of thing that I wanted you to be able to listen for. If you hear something that sounds like it might have a double meaning, chances are it does. And I will be filling in all of those gaps and moments that are kind of obscure as much as I possibly can. The other person he mentions, that Gulliver mentions, is my friend Reldersal. And that appears to be one of a number of different possibilities. But it's probably a real guy. It could have been Charles Viscount Townsend. It could have been John Carteret. It could have Earl of Granville. It's a bunch of different people that it could have been. But conventional wisdom is that it's one of those guys. You are also going to hear him in this chapter talk about these bands of color that the king gives out as favors, blue, red, and green. Now, for those of you who are royal watchers, that'll probably ring a bell for you. For those of you who aren't, blue is the Order of the Garter, red is the Order of the Bath, and green is the Order of the Thistle. And these were honorary title-ish things that were given out to people, and I think still are. I think there are still people who are Order of the Garter that I hear about. Now, one of the ways that Swift continues to make fun of his own time within the confines of Gulliver's view of Lilliput is the way that he has the Emperor act. He gives him almost identical language to any person of royal standing that you've heard in Shakespeare plays or stories you've read or histories you've read. You know, it's all the kind of we who rule the empire of the seven seas, of the grand mountains, of the blah, 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 all of that. And, you know, if you are a king wielding, say, a royal navy and an army, and you've got a contingent of longbows, you've got power on your side. You can get away with that. It's a little different when the guy who's saying it is 6 inches tall. And Swift's point, which I think you'll see is pretty crystal clear, is it is just as ridiculous for a 6-inch emperor, 6 inches tall, to say these things as it is for anyone to say these things. You know, Swift is kind of pre-Enlightenment, but there are some moments where he transcends his time, as all great writers do, and says things that seem awfully pro-women in here, and pro-freedom on a par that you just don't see very often. But this kind of egalitarian attitude of making fun of people in power for acting like the power matters. It's just like he's popping a pin in their balloon and making everything they say sound kind of petty and pretentious because it's a tempest in a teapot kind of thing. Now you will hear we start talking about the island of Blefuscu, and you're going to hear some of the arguments between them. This is quite definitely England and France. Lilliput is England, Blefuscu is France, and there's a bunch of interesting stuff that goes on that you'll understand. The other thing, though, is Isaac Asimov would like you to know that in this portion, when they talk about feeding Gulliver, Swift gets the math right. However, for those of you who are scientifically minded or engineers or anything like that, you're going to hear a bunch of stuff in the next two chapters that's going to drive you nuts because the math is wrong and doesn't make sense. And so when I say the Lilliputians are 6 inches tall, you're going to, different things are going to make you go, "Huh?" Because it's like he's allowing them to change size in the narrative just to make a joke. And so here's the thing. Swift changes their size just to make jokes. and that's fine. He's allowed to do that. He's kind of smart. So I'm just going to let him get away with it and avert my eyes and let that go. Oh, and there is one more guy who he mentions in here and gives a name to. Skyresh Bolgolam is supposed to represent Daniel Finch, Earl of Nottingham. Now, he's a Tory, but he often went against Tories publicly and politically and drove Swift nuts. He was also High Church, and this is going to matter a lot in Chapter 4. High Church, which is virtually Catholic, and Swift was not pro-Catholic. This is after Henry VIII. This is after he's created the Anglican Church, and the tensions between the Catholic and the Anglican churches were palpable. And you will hear it in Swift from time to time. This high and low thing is going to come up more and more, at least within the confines of the Lilliputian politics. All right. So with that, just, you know, giving you that hint to listen for anything ridiculous that Gulliver has to do or that anybody else has to do to curry favor with the emperor, that is Swift absolutely nailing the politics of his own day. And so here we go with Aaron Ziegler reading Chapter 3 of Gulliver's Travels.
Chapter 3. The author diverts the emperor and his nobility of both sexes in a very uncommon manner. The diversions of the court of Lilliput described, the author hath his liberty granted him upon certain conditions. My gentleness and good behavior had gained so far on the emperor and his court, and indeed upon the army and people in general, that I began to conceive hopes of getting my liberty in a short time. I took all possible methods to cultivate this favorable disposition. The natives came by degrees to be less apprehensive of any danger from me. I would sometimes lie down and let 5 or 6 of them dance on my hand. And at last, the boys and girls would venture to come and play at hide-and-seek in my hair. I had now made a good progress in understanding and speaking their language. The emperor had a mind one day to entertain me with several of the country shows, wherein they exceed all nations I have known, both for dexterity and magnificence. I was diverted with none so much as that of the rope dancers, performed upon a slender white thread extended about 2 foot and 12 inches from the ground, upon which I shall desire liberty with the reader's patience to enlarge a little. This diversion is only practiced by those persons who are candidates for great employments and high favor at court. They are trained in this art from their youth and are not always of noble birth or liberal education. When a great office is vacant, either by death or disgrace, which often happens, 5 or 6 of those candidates petition the emperor to entertain his majesty and the court with a dance on the rope, and whoever jumps the highest without falling succeeds in the office. Very often the chief ministers themselves are commanded to show their skill and to convince the emperor that they have not lost their faculty. Flimnap, the treasurer, is allowed to cut a caper on the straight rope at least an inch higher than any other lord in the whole empire. I have seen him do the somerset several times together upon a trencher fixed on the rope, which is no thicker than a common pack thread in England. My friend Reldresal, principal secretary for private affairs, is, in my opinion, if I am not partial, the second after the treasurer. The rest of the great officers are much upon a par. These diversions are often attended with fatal accidents, whereof great numbers are on record. I myself have seen 2 or 3 candidates break a limb, but the danger is much greater when the ministers themselves are commanded to show their dexterity, for by contending to excel themselves and their fellows, they strain so far that there is hardly one of them who hath not received a fall, and some of them 2 or 3. I was assured that 1 or 2 before my arrival, Flimnap would have infallibly broke his neck if one of the king's cushions that accidentally lay on the ground had not weakened the force of his fall. There is likewise another diversion, which is only shown before the emperor and empress and first minister upon particular occasions. The emperor lays on a table 3 fine silk threads of 6 inches long. One is blue, the other red, and the third green. These threads are proposed as prizes for those persons whom the emperor hath a mind to distinguish by a particular mark of his favor. The ceremony is performed in His Majesty's Great Chamber of State, where the candidates are to undergo a trial of dexterity very different from the former, and such as I have not observed the least resemblance of in any other country of the Old or New World. The emperor holds a stick in his hands, both ends parallel to the horizon, while the candidates advance one by one, sometimes leaping over the stick, sometimes creeping under it backwards and forwards several times, according as the stick is advanced or depressed. Sometimes the emperor holds one end of the stick and his minister the other. Sometimes the minister has it entirely to himself. Whoever performs his part with most agility and holds out the longest in leaping and creeping is rewarded with the blue-colored silk. The red is given to the next and the green to the third, which they all wear girt twice round about the middle. And you see few great persons about this court who are not adorned with one of these girdles. The horses of the army and those of the royal stables, having been daily led before me, were no longer shy, but would come up to my very feet without starting. The riders would leap them over my hand as I lay it on the ground, and one of the emperor's huntsmen, upon a large courser, took my foot, shoe and all, which was indeed a prodigious leap. I had the good fortune to divert the emperor one day after a very extraordinary manner. I desired he would order several sticks of 2 foot high and the thickness of an ordinary cane to be brought me, whereupon His Majesty commanded the masters of his woods to give directions accordingly, and the next morning 6 woodmen arrived with as many carriages drawn by 8 horses to each. I took 9 of these sticks, and fixing them firmly in the ground in a quadrangular figure 2 foot and a half square, I took 4 other sticks and tied them parallel at each corner about 2 foot from the ground. Then I fastened my handkerchief to the 9 sticks that stood erect and extended it on all sides till it was as tight as the top of a drum, and the 4 parallel sticks rising about 5 inches higher than the handkerchief served as ledges on each side. When I had finished my work, I desired the emperor to let a troop of his best horses, 24 in number, come and exercise upon this plain. His Majesty approved of the proposal, and I took them up one by one in my hands, ready mounted and armed, with the proper officers to exercise them. As soon as they got into order, they divided into 2 parties, performed mock skirmishes, discharged blunt arrows, drew their swords, fled and pursued, attacked and retreated, and in short, discovered the best military discipline I had ever beheld. The parallel sticks secured them and their horses from falling over the stage, and the emperor was so much delighted that he ordered this entertainment to be repeated several days, and once was pleased to be lifted up and give the word of command, and, with great difficulty, persuaded even the empress herself to let me hold her in her close chair within 2 yards of the stage, from whence she was able to take a full view of the whole performance. 'Twas my good fortune that no ill accident happened in these entertainments. Only once a fiery horse that belonged to one of the captains, pawing with his hoof, struck a hole in my handkerchief, and his foot slipping, he overthrew his rider and himself, but I immediately relieved them both. For covering the hole with one hand, I set down the troop with the other, in the same manner as I had took them up. The horse that fell was strained in the left shoulder, but the rider got no hurt, and I repaired my handkerchief as well as I could. However, I would not trust the strength of it any more in such dangerous enterprises. About 2 or 3 days before I was set at liberty, as I was entertaining the court with these kinds of feats, there arrived an express to inform His Majesty that some of his subjects riding near the place where I was first taken up had seen a great black substance lying on the ground, very oddly shaped, extending its edges round as wide as His Majesty's bedchamber and rising up in the middle as high as a man, that it was no living creature as they at first apprehended, for it lay on the grass without motion, and some of them had walked round it several times, that by mounting upon each other's shoulders, they had got to the top, which was flat and even, and stamping upon it, they found it was hollow within, that they humbly conceived it might be something belonging to the Man Mountain, and if His Majesty pleased, they would undertake to bring it with only 5 horses. I presently knew what they meant, and was glad at heart to receive this intelligence. It seemed, upon my first reaching the shore, after our shipwreck, I was in such confusion that before I came to the place where I went to sleep, my hat, which I had fastened with a string to my head while I was rowing, and had stuck on all the time I was swimming, fell off after I came to land. The string, as I conjecture, breaking by some accident which I never observed, but thought my hat had been lost at sea. I entreated His Imperial Majesty to give orders it might be brought to me as soon as possible, describing to him the use and nature of it. And the next day the wagoners arrived with it, but not in very good condition. They had bored 2 holes in the brim within 1.5 inches of the edge, and fastened 2 hooks in the holes. These hooks were tied by a long cord to the harness, and thus my hat was dragged along for above 1/2 English mile. But the ground in that country being extremely smooth and level, it received less damage than I expected. 2 days after this adventure, the Emperor, having ordered that part of his army, which quarters in and about his metropolis, to be in a readiness, took a fancy of diverting himself in a very singular manner. He desired I would stand like a colossus, with my legs as far asunder as I conveniently could. He then commanded his general, who was an old experienced leader and a great patron of mine, to draw up the troops in close order and march them under me, the foot by 24 in abreast, and the horse by 16, with drums beating, colors flying, and pikes advanced. This body consisted of 3,000 foot and 1,000 horse. His Majesty gave orders, upon pain of death, that every soldier in his march should observe the strictest decency with regard to my person, which, however, could not prevent some of the younger officers from turning up their eyes as they passed under me, and, to confess the truth, my breeches were at the time in so ill a condition that they afforded some opportunities for laughter and admiration. I had sent so many memorials and petitions for my liberty that His Majesty at length mentioned the matter first in the cabinet and then in a full council, where it was opposed by none except Skyresh Bolgalam, who was pleased without any provocation to be my mortal enemy. But it was carried against him by the whole board and confirmed by the Emperor. That minister was Galbit, or Admiral of the Realm, very much in his master's confidence, and a person well versed in affairs, but of a morose and sour complexion. However, he was at length persuaded to comply, but prevailed that the articles and conditions upon which I should be set free, and to which I must swear, should be drawn up by himself. These articles were brought to me by Skyresh Bolgrim in person, attended by 2 undersecretaries and several persons of distinction. After they were read, I was demanded to swear to the performance of them, first in the manner of my own country, and afterwards in the method prescribed by their laws, which was to hold my right foot in my left hand, to place the middle finger of my right hand on the crown of my head, and my thumb on the tip of my right ear. But because the reader may perhaps be curious to have some idea of the style and manner of the expression peculiar to that people, as well as to know the articles upon which I recovered my liberty, I have made a translation of the whole instrument, word for word, as near as I was able, which I here offer to the public. Golbasto, Mamorin, Evlem, Gordilo, Sheffin, Muli Uligu. Most mighty Emperor of Lilliput, delight and terror of the universe, whose dominions extend 5,000 blustrugs, about 12 miles in circumference, to the extremities of the globe, monarch of all monarchs, taller than the sons of men, whose feet press down to the center and whose head strikes against the sun, at whose nod the princes of the earth shake their knees, pleasant as the spring, comfortable as the summer, fruitful as autumn, dreadful as winter. His most sublime majesty proposeth to the Man Mountain, lately arrived at our celestial dominions, the following articles, which by a solemn oath he shall be obliged to perform. First, the Man Mountain shall not depart from our dominions without our license under our great seal. Secondly, he shall not presume to come into our metropolis without our express order, at which time the inhabitants shall have 2 hours' warning to keep within their doors. Thirdly, the said Man Mountain shall confine his walks to our principal high roads, and not offer to walk or lie down in a meadow or field of corn. Fourthly, as he walks the said roads, he shall take the utmost care not to trample upon the bodies of any of our loving subjects, their horses or carriages, nor take any of our said subjects into his hands without their own consent. Fifthly, if an express require extraordinary dispatch, the Man Mountain shall be obliged to carry in his pocket the messenger and horse a 6 days' journey once in every moon, and return the said messenger back, if so required, safe to our imperial presence. Sixthly, he shall be our ally against our enemies in the island of Blefuscu, and do his utmost to destroy their fleet, which is now preparing to invade us. Seventhly, that the said Man Mountain shall, at his times of leisure, be aiding and assisting to our workmen in helping to raise certain great stones towards covering the wall of the principal park and other royal buildings. Eighthly, that the said Man Mountain shall, in 2 moons' time, deliver in an exact survey of the circumference of our dominions by a computation of his own paces round the coast. Lastly, that upon his solemn oath to observe all the above articles, the said Man Mountain shall have a daily allowance of meat and drink sufficient for the support of 1,728 of our subjects, with free access to our royal person and other marks of our favor, given at our palace at Balfour Borak, the 12th day of the 91st moon of our reign. I swore and subscribed to these articles with great cheerfulness and content, although some of them were not so honorable as I could have wished, which proceeded wholly from the malice of Skyresh Bolgolam, the High Admiral. Whereupon, my chains were immediately unlocked, and I was at full liberty. The Emperor himself, in person, did me the honor to be by at the whole ceremony. I made my acknowledgments by prostrating myself at His Majesty's feet, but he commanded me to rise, and after many gracious expressions, which, to avoid the censure of vanity, I shall not repeat, he added that he hoped I should prove a useful servant and well deserve all the favors he had already conferred upon me or might do for the future. The reader may please to observe that in the last article for the recovery of my liberty, the Emperor stipulates to allow me a quantity of meat and drink sufficient for the support of 1,728 Lilliputians. Sometime after, asking a friend at court how they came to fix on that determinate number, he told me that His Majesty's mathematicians, having taken the height of my body by the help of a quadrant, and finding it to exceed theirs in the proportion of 12 to 1, they concluded from the similarity of their bodies that mine must contain at least 1,728 of theirs, and consequently would require as much food as was necessary to support that number of Lilliputians, by which the reader may conceive an idea of the ingenuity of that people, as well as the prudent and exact economy of so great a prince.
And there ends chapter 3. And in this chapter, instead of jokes about urinating, this time it was the one about the people marching underneath his legs when he stood like a colossus, and that his pants were kind of in disrepair, and they were looking up in surprise and also impressed. Swift throws those suckers in. You got to listen for him. He gets zingers in there every once in a while. Now that he's free, he has the liberty to walk around and see more things and do more things. There is a moment in here where he makes fun of the travel narratives again, where he's talking about stuff he's looking at, and then he says, "I shall not anticipate the reader with further descriptions of this kind because I reserve them for a greater work, which is now almost ready for the press, containing a general description of this empire." He's selling his next book, which isn't true. Swift was not writing a new book. But Gulliver is doing exactly what everybody else in his day was doing. Once they published one book, they capitalize on it and advertise for their next book within the current one. And this is how a lot of those voyage stories worked it, which I thought was hilarious. Now, I mentioned before in chapter 3 that you're going to hear the high and low stuff happening. High church, low church. High church is closer to Catholicism. Low church is Anglican, more Protestant. Swift is Protestant. And for this section of the narrative, he makes up names. The Tramixons, or the high heels, are the Tories. So the T word sticks with the Tories. The Slamixons are the Whigs. Tories tended towards high church, more Catholic. Whigs tended toward low church, more Protestant. Now, George I, who's the king, who is the stand-in, or who is the object of ridicule of the emperor of Lilliput, he is a Whig, and the low heels are the Whigs. So you'll be able to hear the George I jokes coming in that section. There's a marvelous section in this chapter where he makes fun of the scientists of his day and how they come to their scientific conclusions. But he doesn't use the word scientist. He uses the word philosopher. So the idea of, or even the term scientist, it really wasn't used for another 100 years. So even though Newton's there doing his Newtonian thing, still talk about philosophy, which is why Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, that's actually a thing. That's a real thing. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone is Hollywood thinking that kids in America can't handle the word philosopher. Actually, I think that was probably Scholastic, wasn't it? Because they put the book out first. Anyway, the Philosopher's Stone, the search for the Philosopher's Stone, all that stuff, that's old story stuff. And the scientists are still called philosophers in Swift's day. And he really takes aim at them in this chapter. He makes quick cracks at things like he talks about a most obstinate war. And the assumption is that he's talking about the war for Spanish succession, which the Whigs supported and the Tories opposed. There's a whole thing about cracking eggs correctly. And there's a rather complicated bit of finger pointing that Henry VIII is the one who split from the Catholic Church. And the correct way to crack eggs is considered to have something to do with church rituals, and that Henry VIII cut himself on the sharpness of Catholic doctrine. You see where it's going? And so the argument between him and the Pope was the only way to deal with it was for them to split. And so you have people who crack their eggs one way and people who crack their eggs another way. And clearly, Swift trying to get at the ridiculousness of this split, he picks the most trivial problem you could have for an argument, how to crack eggs. So the big end of an egg would be the high church, the more Catholic side, and the low end of the egg, or the small end of the egg, would be Protestantism. Right. I know it gets complicated, but that's where he's going with it, with the satire, is commentary on the church. And he's, you know, the unrest was serious, and you hear a lot about the Catholic protests, but it was the Protestant protesters that killed a king. The Protestant revolts were big and effective, and the emperor who lost his life, you'll hear a crack about this in the story, is a clear reference to Charles I. He was a high church Anglican who was executed in 1649 by the Protestants. So Swift doesn't have to go very far back into history to find places where people are willing to kill each other over this stuff. So that's one king who lost his head, another lost his crown. That emperor is a reference to James II, who was Catholic and who was driven from the throne in 1688, again, by Protestants. He does another tricky thing Swift does here. Towards the end of the chapter, you will hear him talking about sacred texts and schisms in religion. And he's talking about a made-up prophet and talks about their holy book, which he calls the Alcoran, A-L-C-O-R-A-N. Now, this is an inspired bit of genius. Yes, it's a reference to the Quran, but he throws it in there to throw people off the scent, because if he was going to claim that the religious schisms that he's talking about here, if anybody was going to point a finger and say, oh, you're talking about our church, you're talking about our Bible, he could be in serious, serious trouble. So instead, he pushes it all over on a different religion entirely and gives himself an out. It's the same thing that he did with the emperor by describing him physically as being attractive and thin when George I was repulsive and huge. He effectively negates any opportunity for somebody to come in and accuse him and, you know, imprison him for making fun of these people, or in this case, making fun of religion. And again, this is all coming out of a guy who is a minister. He's a religious man. He's a very interesting character. And again, you're going to hear Gulliver coming down from a very kind of humanitarian state and making his commentary on whether you should break your eggs at the smaller end or the bigger end. And it's quite an interesting opinion that Gulliver holds. And of course, we know that England and France were at war off and on for a good many hundred years there in this time range. And and so when he talks about these long ongoing wars between the two empires, between the Lilliputians and the people of Blefuscu, that is what he is in fact talking about. So there's that. So I'm going to play the audio of chapter 4 for you and let you listen to Aaron Ziegler for a little bit about the Bigendians and the Smallendians.
Chapter 4. Mildendo, the metropolis of Lilliput, described, together with the emperor's palace, a conversation between the author and a principal secretary concerning the affairs of that empire, the author's offers to serve the emperor in his wars. The first request I made after I had obtained my liberty was that I might have license to see Mildendo, the metropolis, which the emperor easily granted me, but with a special charge to do no hurt either to the inhabitants or their houses. The people had notice by proclamation of my design to visit the town. The wall which encompassed it is 2.5 feet high and at least 11 inches broad, so that a coach and horse might be driven very safely round it, and it is flanked with strong towers at 10 feet distance. I stepped over the great western gate and passed very gently, and sidling through the two principal streets only in my short waistcoat, for fear of damaging the roofs and eaves of the houses with the skirts of my coat. I walked with the utmost circumspection to avoid treading on any stragglers who might remain in the streets, although the orders were very strict that all people should keep in their houses at their own peril. The garret windows and tops of the houses were so crowded with spectators that I thought in all my travels I had not seen a more populous place. The city is an exact square, each side of the wall being 500 feet long. The two great streets which run cross and divide it into four quarters are 5 feet wide. The lanes and alleys which I could not enter, but only viewed them as I passed, are from 12 to 18 inches. The town is capable of holding 500,000 souls. The houses are from 3 to 5 stories, the shops and markets well provided. The emperor's palace is in the center of the city, where the two great streets meet. It is enclosed by a wall of 2 feet high and 20 feet distant from the buildings. I had his majesty's permission to step over this wall, and the space being so wide between that and the palace, I could easily view it on every side. The outward court is a square of 40 feet and includes two other courts. In the inmost are the royal apartments, which I was very desirous to see, but found it extremely difficult. For the great gates from one square into another were but 8 inches high and 7 inches wide. Now the buildings of the outer court were at least 5 feet high, and it was impossible for me to stride over them without infinite damage to the pile, although the walls were strongly built of hewn stone and 4 inches thick. At the same time, the emperor had a great desire that I should see the magnificence of his palace. But this I was not able to do till 3 days after, which I spent in cutting down with my knife some of the largest trees in the royal park, about 100 yards distant from the city. Of these trees, I made 2 stools, each about 3 foot high and strong enough to bear my weight. The people, having received notice a second time, I went again through the city to the palace with my 2 stools in my hands. When I came to the side of the outer court, I stood upon 1 stool and took the other in my hand. This I lifted over the roof and gently set it down on the space between the 1st and 2nd court, which was 8 foot wide. I then stepped over the buildings very conveniently from 1 stool to the other and drew up the 1st after me with a hooked stick. By this contrivance, I got into the inmost court, and lying down upon my side, I applied my face to the windows of the middle stories, which were left open on purpose, and discovered the most splendid apartments that can be imagined. There I saw the empress and the young princes in their several lodgings with their chief attendants about them. Her Imperial Majesty was pleased to smile very graciously upon me, and gave me out of the window her hand to kiss. But I shall not anticipate the reader with further descriptions of this kind, because I reserve them for a greater work which is now almost ready for the press, containing a general description of this empire from its first erection through a long series of princes, with a particular account of their wars and politics, laws, learnings and religion, their plants and animals, their peculiar manners and customs, with other matters very curious and useful. My chief design at present being only to relate such events and transactions as happened to the public or to myself during the residence of about 9 months in that empire. One morning, about a fortnight after I had obtained my liberty, Reldresal, principal secretary, as they style him, of private affairs, came to my house, attended only by 1 servant. He ordered his coach to wait at a distance and desired I would give him an hour's audience, which I readily consented to, on account of his qualities and personal merits, as well as of the many good offices he had done me during my solicitations at court. I offered to lie down that he might the more conveniently reach my ear, but he chose rather to let me hold him in my hand during our conversation. He began with compliments on my liberty, said he might pretend to some merit in it, but, however, added that if it had not been for the present situation of things at court, perhaps I might not have obtained it so soon. For, said he, as flourishing a condition as we appear to be in to foreigners, we labor under 2 mighty evils, a violent faction at home, and the danger of an invasion by a most potent enemy from abroad. As to the 1st, you are to understand that for above 70 moons past, there have been 2 struggling parties in this empire under the names of Tramaxan and Slamaxan, from the high and low heels on their shoes, by which they distinguish themselves. It is alleged, indeed, that the high heels are most agreeable to our ancient constitution. But, however this be, His Majesty hath determined to make use of only low heels in the administration of the government and all offices in the gift of the crown. As you cannot but observe, and particularly that His Majesty's imperial heels are lower at least by a drurer than any of his court.
Drurer is a measure about the 14th part of an inch.
The animosities between these 2 parties run so high that they will neither eat nor drink nor talk with each other. We compute the Tramaxan or high heels to exceed us in number, but the power is wholly on our side. We apprehend His Imperial Highness, the heir to the crown, to have some tendency toward the high heels. At least we can plainly discover one of his heels higher than the other, which gives him a hobble in his gait. Now, in the midst of these intestine disquiets, we are threatened with an invasion from the island of Blefuscu, which is the other great empire of the universe, almost as large and powerful as this of His Majesty.
For as to what we have heard, you affirm that there are other kingdoms and states in the world inhabited by human creatures as large as yourself. Our philosophers are in much doubt, and would rather conjecture that you dropped from the moon, or one of the stars, because it is certain that 100 mortals of your bulk would, in a short time, destroy all the fruits and cattle of His Majesty's dominions. Besides, our histories of 6,000 moons make no mention of any other regions than the two great empires of Lilliput and Blefuscu, which two mighty powers have, as I was going to tell you, been engaged in a most obstinate war for 36 moons past. It began upon the following occasion. It is allowed on all hands that the primitive way of breaking eggs before we eat them was upon the larger end. But His present Majesty's grandfather, while he was a boy, going to eat an egg and breaking it according to the ancient practice, happened to cut one of his fingers. Whereupon the emperor, his father, published an edict commanding all his subjects upon great penalties to break the smaller end of their eggs. The people so highly resented this law that our histories tell us there have been 6 rebellions raised on that account, wherein one emperor lost his life and another his crown. These civil commotions were constantly fomented by the monarchs of Blefuscu, and when they were quelled, the exiles always fled for refuge to that empire. It is computed that 11,000 persons have, at several times, suffered death rather than submit to break their eggs at the smaller end. Many 100 large volumes have been published upon this controversy, but the books of the big Endians have been long forbidden, and the whole party rendered incapable by law of holding employments. During the course of these troubles, the emperors of Blefuscu did frequently expostulate by their ambassadors, accusing us of making a schism in religion by offending against a fundamental doctrine of our great prophet Lustrog in the 54th chapter of the Brendrikol, which is their Al-Quran. This, however, is thought to be a mere strain upon the text, for the words are these: that all true believers shall break their eggs at the convenient end. And which is the convenient end seems, in my humble opinion, to be left to every man's conscience, or at least in the power of the chief magistrate to determine. Now, the big Endians, exiles, have found so much credit in the emperor of Blefuscu's court, and so much private assistance and encouragement from their party here at home, that a bloody war hath been carried on between the two empires for 36 moons, with various successes, during which time we have lost 40 capital ships, and a much greater number of smaller vessels, together with 30,000 of our best seamen and soldiers, and the damage received by the enemy is reckoned to be somewhat greater than ours. However, they have now equipped an enormous fleet, and are just preparing to make a descent upon us, and His Imperial Majesty, placing great confidence in your valor and strength, hath commanded me to lay this account of his affairs before you.
I desired the secretary to present my humble duty to the emperor, and to let him know that I thought it would not become me, who was a foreigner, to interfere with parties, but I was ready, with the hazard of my life, to defend his person and state against all invaders.
Well, now we know how long Gulliver's been there, and we know that they are gearing up for a war. And I love Aaron Ziegler's voices that he does. I find that to be enormously helpful in hearing the text. I hope you did too. So the entire, lest you be deceived, the entire book is not going to be making fun of religion. It's just, I think, honestly, it's an easy target to start with. Like many satires, he kind of starts with the easy stuff that people can go, about. And then he moves into the harder stuff that has more to do with human nature. So that's definitely where we're headed, but we have to work our way there. So next up is going to be war and military strategy, I imagine, because they're gearing up for a war. So it'll give Swift some fodder to take aim in that direction. And on that note, I will leave you. We've got a busy weekend. We've got a Mother's Day weekend. I hope all of you mothers out there have a marvelous time with your families. I have no idea what I'm going to be doing for Mother's Day, so I'm hoping that I have a good one too. And I will talk to you in a week. Take care. Bye. There are many ways to listen to Craftlit. You can listen on your smartphone via the Stitcher Radio app. You can subscribe free through iTunes, or you can download and listen to the iPhone, iTouch, and Android app, where you'll receive occasional extras for the show. Craftlit is supported in a number of ways. Knit Circus, the free e-newsletter featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at knitcircus.com. Also, the What Would Madame Defarge Knit series, Volume 2, What Else Would Madame Defarge Knit, is now in pre-orders. You can find out more from the links in the show notes at craftlit.com. Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories from the heart and home. And Seedpod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative publishing books, not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. If you would like to help support the show, please know there are various ways to donate, and all of them help keep Craftlit and Just the Books free and available to you whenever you feel the need for a good story. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.